Well, good afternoon, brethren. I must say, I actually truly enjoyed that special music. Mostly because I like unique pieces, so that was for our bit. No, actually, I really love that first song. You know what I love about it? And the choir probably doesn't know they do this, but that's one song where by the third time they get going, they all start swaying. I don't know if you ever noticed that. And then they start doing it in unison. I just love that about that song for some reason. Because every time I hear that one comes, I sit back there and smile, waiting for that moment. And I'll echo again the welcome of all of our guests today. It's a pleasure having you here, and I hope you enjoy your time at the Opry. And there might be some dancing, I don't know. Probably not you guys, but somebody else might be dancing. And before I guess, start my timer, I have to confess something. I got asked a question this week. And I'm going to give you my answer, and then when I tell you what the question was, you will understand the anxiety that I had with this question. My answer came in an email. My answer was two words: no, comma, why? Question mark. And it was Thursday, and my wife saying, "Hey, are you speaking this week?" So. Thankfully, that question came in. So whatever you think of this sermon, it is better than it would have been had that email not come. So anyway, enough about that. I will start my timer. Brethren, if someone were to ask you where and how you see the glory of God in this life, what would your answer be? Would it be the great creation we have, standing in the Grand Canyon and looking at beautiful vistas? Would it be staring at the stars and looking at the marvelous and wonderful view that you get to see? Would it be God's laws? Would you see the glory of God in His laws and the great gift that it is to us to have instructions on how to conduct life? What about the plan of salvation? There's glory in that. What about just the cycle of life, birth? How beautiful is that? And to see, especially as a father, see your young children grow up. I want to ask another question. How many of us have experienced some form of conflict in the past week? How many of us right now have conflict in our life? Well, believe it or not, these two questions are intimately linked. And the answer, not the question so much, I guess the answers are intimately linked. In fact, we're going to spend the rest of the message showing how tightly coupled they are. I want to put forth the proposition to you that how we respond to conflict is one of the greatest ways we personally can show the glory of our great God. Conflict is universal. If you are drawing breath, you have had, do have, or will have conflict with your neighbor, your spouse, coworkers, friends, children, random strangers driving down the road, or any other place you bump into them. You will have conflict. Again, I want to approach conflict from a slightly different perspective, one that we don't often go to. I'm not here, and I will have no points. No, here's how you handle it. Here's no how you manage it. Here's how you, step A, do this, step B, do this, step C, and you might come to some sort of resolution. I simply want to frame and form the foundation for how we handle conflict, more specifically, how we reconcile and why we do that and why it's important. I want to start really by going back to my original question and taking a look at God's self-declared glory. What is it that our God says is His glory? I think it's a good place to start. We can start by turning over to Exodus chapter 33. It is exceptionally important, I believe, to understanding the few verses we will read, but we must put them into the broader context of the moment in which they're framed. We are so familiar with this story in the Church of God. Anybody that's a student of the Bible will be intimately familiar with it. This is a crucial point in the history of God's chosen people. We know the Exodus story. We know them coming out of Egypt. We know the redemptive process that took place. And we know that this is a type of our redemption and our coming out of the world and our being set free from the devil or Pharaoh, if you will. And again, contextually, Israel, Moses, Aaron are all at this sort of fulcrum in the story. God had rescued them from some of the harshest bondage. In fact, those he rescued, that is all they ever knew, was harsh bondage. He used his servants to do so, Moses and Aaron. Israelites, because it wasn't just Israelites, it says Israelites, a mixed multitude, flocks and herds, you know, again, tens and hundreds of thousands of people coming out of Exodus. What started out with a great high hand and great joy turned soon to fear and accusation. Then comes the attacks against Moses, where the Israelites proclaimed, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die into the wilderness?" One of their first accusations, quite frankly. It's astonishing that they got there that quick. Later, they ran into issues at the sea. What did they do? "Why have you brought us out of Egypt?" Later, they came into bitter water and they complained. After that, they needed food. And the whole congregation of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron. They ran out of water again. And the people, and this time, contended with Moses. Again, open rebellion, arguing and going after him. It's a side note, but it's actually an interesting study to go back and watch the progression. It starts with an unmet need, basic necessities of life, turns into accusations, turns into questioning, turns into people complaining, then the whole congregation complaining. Then they contend. And shortly after this, some rebel openly. It's an interesting progression. Mount Sinai. Shortly after the crossing of the sea, they received the commandments, a wonderful, detailed instruction from our God. And it says all the people saw, all the people heard. There was no doubt. Moses didn't go carve something he thought would be interesting for people to do. They all saw, they all heard. And again, the people rebelled quickly. They separated themselves from God and went their own way, effectively. God even said, they have turned aside. And this is all within a very compact window. God says, I'm going to consume them. I'll start over with you, Moses. And Moses pleads with God as an advocate would. And he bases his defense on who God is, not the value, quite frankly, even of the people. He said, you're God. You can't do this. You've made a promise. It also says, and I'm just sort of narrowing this down to the perspective of Moses, which is where we're going to end or talk about. Aaron, his right-hand man. Think about this. His confidant, his right-hand man. It says he didn't restrain the people when he was right there watching them make a calf. It was Aaron's job to restrain the people. And he didn't do it. After the people separated themselves, God in turn separates himself. If you recall the story, God says, take my tent out of the people. Put me out there. You can come out and talk to me, but I can't be among the people or I will consume them. It's a very contentious time. Quite frankly, if we were Moses, it's a very difficult time. I would argue very discouraging point. There's a whirlwind of conflict, a whirlwind of strife and complaining and accusations and revolts going all around him, directed toward every single servant of God. And again, as I mentioned, his own leaders, Moses' own allies, if you will, his closest inner circle failed him. And at the time, thousands of people had died. I would suspect most disconcerting to Moses was the fact that God had chosen and saw necessary to separate himself from the midst. And again, he was willing. And Moses heard this. He was willing to destroy the people for all that they had done. Moses begs and pleads God to go with them. He says, if you don't go with us, please don't send us. Again, it is an enormously conflicting time. It is an enormously difficult time for Moses. And I would argue conflict on every side. Quite frankly, you can argue conflict with the people, conflict with his allies, and a little bit of conflict with God. Because he's contending, don't go. So put yourself in Moses' shoe. And if we do, it will be very informative for us to consider what I term or look at as the Solomon-esque question that Moses asked God. Again, contextually, remember as we read this, where Moses' head is and all that he just experienced and all that he's going through and the unsure future he has. And again, at a minimum, the conflict that he's going through. Exodus 33. We'll start in verse 11. And again, remember, the core question we're driving to is, what does God say his glory is? Because it forms the foundation for us. So the Lord spoke to Moses, verse 11. So the Lord spoke to Moses face to face as a man speaks with his friend. And he would return to the camp. But his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, did not depart from the tabernacle. Remember, he's got to go out of the camp now to the tabernacle to talk to God. Then Moses said to the Lord, see, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know who you will send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by name, and you have found grace in my sight. Again, you can see Moses really having this tension and this you told me to do all this, but you're not telling me who I'm going. I think this is perfectly logical, and obviously God was okay with it. But I think we can all understand the need Moses had here at this time. Verse 13, now therefore I pray, if I have found grace in your sight, show me now your way, that I may know you, and that I may find grace in your sight, and consider that this nation is your people. Again, an enormous approach, a wonderful approach. If this is true, God, if what you're telling me is true, this is what I need. I need this now. In the depths of all of the conflict, I begin to need these things. Verse 14, and he said, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. Again, I think that's those two verses, in some sense, sum up the total walk of a Christian life. You will have conflict. But if you know this, if you know the presence of our great God is with you, prophetically, you will have peace. It may not happen in this life. And in Moses' life, it really never did. I suppose he got some peace toward the end. Verse 15. Then he said to him, again, this is Moses coming back to God, if your presence does not go with us, do not bring us up from here. Again, I'm staying here with you. If you're not going to go with us, then we're not leaving. For how then will it be known that your people and I have found grace in your sight, except you go with us? So we shall be separate, your people and I, from all the people who are upon the face of the earth. So the Lord said to Moses, I will also do this thing which you have spoken, for you have found grace in my sight, and I know you by name. And he said, and here's, I think, the Solomon-esque request. Moses said, please show me your glory. Again, after all the request, after eliciting the commitment from God, saying, I will go with you. I will do this. He still comes back and says, I need to see your glory. And this is not an idle curiosity. Because if it was, God would not have honored the request. This is a genuine need that a servant of God has. Verse 19, then he said, this is then God said, I will make all my goodness pass before you. God says, I'll do that. And I'm going to make all my goodness pass before you. The word all is one we ought to keep in mind. I'm going to make all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. God says, you know what? You're right. I will honor that request. You want to see my glory? I'm going to make it all pass before you. And I'm going to proclaim the name so you get it. So you understand who I am. Drop down to chapter 34, verse 5. Now the Lord descended in the cloud. Again, we know this story. The Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. Remember, he said, all my goodness. Verse 6. And the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquities of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. So Moses made haste and bowed his head toward the earth and worshiped. Here is God's self-proclaimed goodness and glory. There is in this a phenomenal implication that sometimes we can read over. Consider what God says. Go through the list. Mercy, graciousness or grace, long-suffering, patience. Again, I'm adding in other words. Goodness, truth, mercy, forgiving iniquity, sin, and transgression. God says, this is my goodness. This is my glory. And embedded in this is a fundamental truth. God does not need those attributes if there's no conflict. If there's no conflict, you don't need mercy. If there's no conflict, you don't need to suffer long with somebody that is against or doing something against what you would want them to do. God's essentially saying, my glory, who I am, who I want to show you, I want to represent myself to you as somebody who forgives. Somebody who reconciles himself with you. That's my glory. This is an astonishing truth. You don't need those things. Again, if everybody automatically thought exactly the same thing and did exactly the same thing, and everybody did, and nobody ever did anything that I didn't want them to, I don't know what I'd be in conflict with them on. And I wouldn't need patience. There are, in one sense, I suspect, many things God could have pointed to answer Moses' question. But again, at this moment, at this time, in Moses' life, with all the turmoil around him, God said, "This is, you need to understand this. And you, Moses, need to develop these same things." It's important before we leave this, because this will come up later too. God, in all of this, says, yeah, I'll do all that. But the consequences of sin are still dealt with. That is a merciful, loving God. The consequences of our conflict, Moses, you, the people, all that's gone on here, they're going to be real. I'm going to be out there. You're going to be here. I'm not dwelling with you in the same way anymore. I'll be with you. I'll be your God. I'll be present. But we could have had a much closer relationship than we did. They have consequences. And he said, he's just not going to suspend the consequence and the result of an evil or a conflictual relationship. There will be results. Sin is dealt with, and it is always dealt with. Turn, if you would, to Colossians. Brethren, you and I, we are called We are mandated, if you will, if I can use that strong a term, to exhibit this same glory. We may have conflict with this world. Let me rephrase that one. We will have conflict with this world. If you are at all adhering to the biblical principles, you will have conflict with this world. We may have conflict within the church. We may have conflict within our family. And I'll bookend it with this. We will have conflict with our old man. Brethren, it is core. It is so core, I don't think you can dig deep enough to find the true center. It is core of our calling to deal with conflict. It is our duty before our God, because He went before us and He set the example. And He calls us to do the same thing. The Apostle Paul masterfully summarizes this same dynamic to the church at Colossae. Colossians 3, we'll start in verse 1. This is our calling, brethren. If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. We have come out of a watery grave. We were raised with Christ. That's you and I, brethren. Verse 2, set your mind. Again, it's not an accidental, unintentional, oops, I stumbled into it. This is a purposeful decision. You, brethren, set your mind on the things above, not on the things of the earth. For you died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with Him in glory. Yes, I suppose we will have the same appearance. But based upon what we just said, brethren, will you appear with Him in glory? Mercy, goodness, long-suffering, forgiving sin, transgression, iniquity. Will we appear with Him? We must have the same characteristics too. Again, Paul's walking through the Christian walk here. We've been called. He now switches gears, kind of shifts into second. Says, yes, that's the basis. You've got this relationship. Your God called you. He opened your mind. He put His mind and His spirit in you. You're going to have conflict within your own self, with the old man. Verse 5, therefore put to death. Don't play with them. Don't dawdle with them. Put to death your members which are on the earth. Fornication, uncleanliness, passions, evil desires, covetousness, which is idolatry. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience, in which you yourself once walked when you lived in them. But now, you yourselves are to put off all these anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. Not tomorrow. We don't do this. We don't put all this off. We do it now, today. We don't do these things and say, well, in the millennium, I'll get rid of my anger. In the millennium, I'll deal with my malice and my wrath. No, he says, but now, these must come from our mortal bodies. Verse 9, do not lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds and have put on the new man, who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of Him who created him. It's an interesting idea, the image of Him. Keep that thought in mind. Again, Paul shifts gears, puts it into third. Verse 11, now there's conflict we have to deal with out the body. Although one would argue, could be within or start within. Verse 11, where there is neither Greek nor Jew, circumcised nor uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave nor free, but Christ is all and in all. there will be conflict. Again, between people for seemingly, just on the surface, sometimes odd reasons. You're a woman. Oh, okay. Well, you're a guy. Oh, okay. And then there's conflict because we think differently or whatever. He's saying, yeah, you're going to have to deal with this. You're called. You're going to have conflict within. You're going to have conflict without. And he shifts gear one last time. Kicks it into overdrive, if you will. Verse 12. Therefore, one of those lovely transition words for Paul's. Because of all of this. Because you've been called on Christ. And because of all the conflict and all the issues and all the work you have to do as a Christian. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on, what does he ask us to put on? Tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, learning or bearing with one another, and forgiving one another. If any has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. As I said, brethren, this is an obligation on us. You must do it. Thinking through verse 12 and 13. Do you, brethren, do you hear the distant echoes back to Exodus? Of what God said was His essential glory. Mercy. Kindness. Long-suffering. Humility. Meekness. Verse 14. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. Love then is the glue that binds together kindness and mercy, coupled with humility and meekness, and allows you to bear and suffer long with somebody that, yes, you're in conflict with. And yes, isn't doing what you want. And yes, may have a different view on the world and life. It's love that binds all those things together. It's the glue that holds it. And it is the glue that allows you to do any one of those things. Think about it. In the midst of conflict, what if you had a little mercy on the other person instead of sitting there demanding mercy from them? Now, I know we do it in our heads. I've been in plenty of conflict. I know at least what goes on in my head. But what if you were the one to extend the mercy? What if you were the one to give a little kindness right then? In the middle of an argument, what if you had a little more humility in your life and stopped the proud boasting and standing on shaky ground the half the time we stand on just because we don't want to admit we're wrong? And you can go through the entire list. Again, echoes back to the very essential glory of our God. We just got asked to do. Verse 15, and let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which also you were called in one body, and be thankful. Let the peace of God will result. It is an outcome that will ensue. And we have one body, brethren. Regardless of how we want to do our own thing humanly, God sees His people wherever they assemble as one. And that's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. Essentially, God in these verses through Paul is saying, since you're my children, verse 1 and 2, since I called you, since I put my spirit in you, I need you to bear the family image. It's our call. When people look at you, I ask you, brethren, when people look at you individually or as a group, families, churches, whatever. Do they see God? Do they see the family image? I'm not saying they'll acknowledge what it is or recognize it as what it is. The question is, do they see it? More specific to our topic today, do they see it in how we treat each other in the midst of conflict? If we marshaled 100 people randomly off the street into our body here today, I think it's great. I don't know how many churches are represented here, different from, you know, breakoffs from worldwide. I think it's great. If they came in and saw, would they see these attributes bore out in our life? They should. We should all be exhibiting these. Brethren, essentially, unity. These are sort of euphemistic words I'm using, or related words. But reconciliation, one body. Our ability to reconcile our conflicts and our differences should so confound this world that they will see God. All the early churches really gave us a good example. God did a glorious and a marvelous thing to kick off the church. He brought together wildly different people. We alluded to it earlier. All different backgrounds, some of which literally despised each other. And I know there are conflicts around. I got them in my family. I got them in my work. I got them here. You know, it's just the way it is. None of them rise to the level of despising each other. But Jews and Gentiles despised each other. And God brought them all together, put them in one room. It was a marvelous thing. Again, imagine former Shia, Sunni, atheist, Marxist, Jews, Catholic, Protestant, Democrat, Republican sitting in one room, not just cooperating or sort of sitting in their little fiefdoms around the room, but actually reconciling. It will do exactly what God wants it to. It will confound the world to the point where they recognize there's something different about that group. There's something special. I think the way Christ words it, which we're going to read here in a minute, they will know me. They will know God. I find that an astonishing result that can happen because we have reconciled and we have developed those same attributes. Brethren, all of this is true of us today, as much as it was the early church. We need to have a situation where we stand out from the world. So much so, again, that others would take notice. Because it's so different than the way things are handled out there. Brethren, the solution to conflict was modeled for us through the redemptive work of Jesus Christ. In some of his final words, he asked the Father that his disciples would be one. We're familiar with it. You probably all know where I'm headed. You could probably start turning there. We read it so much. Just as they are, though. The question I have and want to explore is why? Why did God say, I want that unity in my body? Turn to John chapter 17. What did Christ, another way of wording the same question, what did Christ himself say the outcome would be of this kind of unity, of this kind of conflict resolution, if you will? Again, not the absence of war, but true peace, as we've alluded to, true reconciliation. John chapter 17, we'll pick it up in verse 20. He says, I do not pray for these alone. He's talking about his... This is one of my favorite chapters in the Bible. Intimate prayer we have of Christ praying to the Father. It's a phenomenally intimate prayer. But anyway, verse 20 says, I do not pray for these alone, but also for those who will believe in me through their word. Look around the room, brethren. You and I believe in him through their word. We're reading it now. So Christ, in essence, is praying for you and I, and wherever else on this Sabbath day God's people are assembled. Verse 21, that they all may be one. Not two, not 30, one. As your Father, excuse me, as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be one in us. Why? He gives the answer right after this, that the world may believe that you sent me. That's an astonishing thing, brethren, that our oneness should be so different, so profound, so unique, that the world believes. Verse 22, and the glory. He goes right back to some of the things we talked about in Exodus. And the glory with which you gave me, I have given them. Think about it. He has given us a glory already. We don't look glorious like everybody thinks. You know, we're not glowing. We don't have halo, whatever. He's saying, I've given them a glory. I've given them the example of mercy, long-suffering, patience, leading to reconciliation. God said, that's my glory. Christ, you're in essence saying, I've given that to them. I've given them the words and the background, the wisdom, and an example to follow. And he gives the reason that they may be one just as we are one. He gave us the means to reconcile. Brethren, without this, again, I started this by saying, Christ is the path. Without that, I don't know how to reconcile, because I would be pretty stubborn about my opinion of how things ought to be. Christ showed the way. He gave us the glory. Remember, this prayer is to all those who would believe. That's to you and me. Verse 23, I in them and you in me, that they may be made perfect in one. And here he says it again, and that the world may know. That the world may know, not other Christian groups, not other fellowships. I presume they're in the body of Christ. I assume they have unity. I assume they're working. But the world should see this. I think that's an astonishing leap farther in my head than I'd ever taken it, to be honest with you. That the world should recognize there's something there. And he even takes it a bit further. It's not just some amorphous thing, some blob. He said the world should know that you sent me. The world should understand that Christ came to this earth by how you and I act, in essence. And they should also know that you have loved them as you loved me. Now I understand the world may not recognize it today. And I would argue that statement is a bit prophetic. But I don't think we should just shrug it off to prophetic that yes, someday when Christ returns in the revelation, all of a sudden their eyes are open. They go, wow, I get it now. That will happen. And they'll know and they'll glorify our God. But I don't think we should relegate it all to that. I think in the context of this, they should have some awareness now. Again, how do we handle our conflict? I have a question which I've been alluding to so far, but I'll have a question I would ask us all to consider. Would you, individually, would you describe your relationships this way? Would you describe them so amazing, so close, so reconciled, that those around you are like, wow, there's something up with them. I can't say that. And again, we all know the scripture, so I'll put it out there. We all know that, yes, it is as much as depend on you, live peaceably with all men. You can't always come to a completely reconciled state. God gives us guidance for that. But within this body, within the churches of God, we ought to be at peace. We ought to be reconciled. Within our families, with our spouses, we ought to be at peace. And we ought to be reconciled. Again, as much as live possibly, or is possible, live peaceably with all men. As I mentioned, the only true answer the core truth of my life anyway. The only true answer to reconciliation is Jesus Christ in us. There's no other path under heaven or earth whereby this can happen. It will be through living Jesus Christ, His way, His mind, His heart within us. I'll throw out another thought for you to consider. To the extent we have peaceful, reconciled relationships, it is a barometer to how willingly we emulate our brother. I would ask you to consider that statement. You can argue with me, you can disagree with me. I'm not saying it's the only measure, but I believe it's a strong indicator of how willing we are to act, to think, to function like our brother Jesus Christ. How willing we are to stand in the shoes of a God that stood there and talked to Moses and said, "This is what I'll do for you. This is who I am. This is my glory. I want you to have that same glory." Brethren, reconciliation is a foundational requirement of our calling. You say it's hard. You say it's difficult. Yes, it is. But God says we have to carry forward the message. We have to carry forward the message of reconciliation. We have to work at it. We have to labor at it. And it is a lifelong endeavor. My family's always irritating me, to be honest with you. Thankfully, none of them are here to give me the dirty look. They're listening. And it's a constant cycle. And I know I irritate them. But it's work. And it's labor. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Again, brethren, yes, it's hard work. It is hard labor. We read the word earlier, meekness, humility. It takes that. Because I promise you, to truly be reconciled, you have to get pride out of your life. If you approach a reconciliation from a prideful standpoint, it ain't going to be reconciled. You may get some sort of peace and resolution, but you're not going to end up reconciled. 2 Corinthians 5, we'll start in verse 17. "Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. Now all things are of God, who has reconciled us to Himself through Jesus Christ." So again, God took the initiative and He reconciled us to Himself through Christ and has given us the ministry of reconciliation. Now I understand He's talking to some ministers, but brethren, we are all in this boat to some degree. Whether we are an official minister or not, we have a ministry of reconciliation. Why? Because it's the core of a Christian walk. It's the core of who we are. And it is the thing God says, and Christ said in His very prayer, that the world would know who you are because you can do this. So you have a ministry of reconciliation. It is your call. It is your duty. Verse 19, that is, God was in Christ reconciling the world to Himself, not imputing their trespasses to them, and has committed to us the word of reconciliation. Brother, again, there is a huge implication here that we too are to be reconciled the way He did, which, not imputing their trespasses to them, that is so hard. Because, brethren, I know, every one of you, I do, I want my pound of flesh when somebody does something against me. I want it. We have to be able to not impute their trespasses to them. Verse 20, "Now then, we are ambassadors for Christ." We're emissaries. Do we see ourselves that way? "We are ambassadors for Christ as though God were pleading through us. We implore you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God. For he made him who knew no sin to be sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. He's not done. He continues on in the next chapter, 2 Corinthians 6. Well, if you didn't read, start in verse 1. We then, again, in context, he's coming off this, you are ambassadors, ministry of reconciliation. Okay, we then, us, as workers, together with him. Workers. We then, as workers together with him, also plead with you not to receive the grace of God in vain. Don't receive this reconciling gift you have from God for no good purpose. Don't receive it for vain reasons, which is worthless. Verse 2, for he says, in an acceptable time, I have heard you, and the day of salvation I have helped you. Behold, now is an acceptable time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. Notice the present tense. Again, it has echoed back to Christ. Now is the time. Now we must be reconciled. We must be put our mind consciously and purposefully to the work of being reconciled. Verse 3, we give no offense in anything that our ministry may not be blamed, but in all things we commend ourselves as ministers of God, in much patience, tribulation, in needs, in distresses, in stripes, in imprisonment, in tumults, in labors, in sleeplessness, in fastings. That's a long list. I imagine there's a lot of difficulty and a lot of conflict in every one of those. You don't get tumults without some form of conflict. You don't become in prison unless you're in conflict with somebody. Verse 6, by purity, by knowledge, by long-suffering, by kindness, by the Holy Spirit, by sincere love. Again, a similar list. Verse 7, by the word of truth, by the power of God, by the armor of righteousness on the right hand and on the left, by honor and dishonor, by evil report, by good report, by deceivers, or as deceivers and yet true. As unknown and yet well known, as dying and behold we live, as chastened and yet not killed, as sorrowful yet always rejoicing, as poor yet making many rich, as having nothing and yet possessing all things. Huge dichotomy. This isn't going to make sense to the world. Don't be surprised if they're confused by it. But they should see the difference. Christ told us, by this all will know that you are my disciples if you have love one for another. Everybody will know. I mentioned it earlier. I want to turn back and look at some of Christ's instructions. Luke chapter 6. Again, another section of verse that we're familiar with. But Christ gives us some of the most interesting instructions, because he came for the work, the redemptive work of reconciling us. Luke chapter 6, we'll start in verse 32. But if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you hope to receive back, what credit is that to you? For even the sinners lend to sinners to receive as much back. Essentially saying, brethren, this is the common. This is the ordinary. These are things anybody will do, and there's nothing extraordinary about it. Doing those things, you will not have the result Christ said he would have of his disciples, that the world may know you sent me. This is common. This is ordinary. Verse 35, but love your enemies. Do good and lend, hoping for nothing in return. And your reward will be great, and you will be the sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the unthankful and the evil. See, I do not know how to do that without God. I don't know how to love enemies without him. And you can see the heart of reconciliation coming through in one verse and one set of instructions to us. Love your enemies because, and I'm skipping the middle part, because He is kind to the unthankful and the evil. Verse 36, therefore be merciful. Brethren, you were shown mercy. Mercy has been extended to every single one of you. Now He's saying you be merciful to others, just as your Father is also merciful. Judge not. Yeah. Judge not, that you shall not, and you shall not be judged. Condemn not, and you shall not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your bosom. For with the same measure you use, it will be measured back to you. So, again, an astonishing principle, brethren. Give mercy. You want mercy in your life? God's saying, don't worry, this is how it's going to work. This is just retribution. This is a just cause. Give mercy. Give it liberally. I need mercy in the day of judgment. He's saying, with the same measure, I dish it out. He's going to measure it to me. Give mercy, I say. Give forgiveness. Give kindness. Give generously. Give freely. In other words, rise above the ordinary. Rise above the mundane. Rise above those who will lend to those who will give them back. Lend to somebody and don't expect anything back. Give mercy and don't expect anything back. Give kindness and don't expect anything back. Give forgiveness. And yes, don't expect anything back. It doesn't say it here, but I'll add, be profoundly grateful when you get it. If somebody genuinely forgives you, be grateful. He then goes on and gives an interesting parallel, a parable connected to these thoughts. And He spoke a parable to them, verse 39. Can the blind lead the blind? Will they not both fall into the ditch? A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone who is perfectly trained will be like his teacher. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not perceive the plank in your own eye? You can perceive. It's not like you're unaware of it. It's just you didn't behold it. You didn't consider it. Consider it. Consider you have a plank. You know it's there. Verse 42, or how can you say to your brother, brother, let me remove the speck that is in your eye, when you yourself do not see the plank that is in your own eye? Hypocrite! First remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Again, and I know this parable is often used and typically used to represent this idea that you have this awful sin and you're over there criticizing somebody else for this little sin that they may have. But they don't have the awful sin, see, but they just got this little one. I offer a different or an alternative perspective. I'm not dismissing that, by the way, but this perspective helped me, so I hope it helps you. Think of it this way. When it comes to my sins, this plank in my eye, I can see big Roman numerals. I get Roman numeral 1. Frankie's got pride. Roman numeral 2. He's a little arrogant. Roman numeral 3. Whatever. I can go down that list and I can tell you what it is. But when it comes to other people, I'm like, yep, I can see. Yep, there's pride. But instead of that, I can also say, yeah, it's Roman numeral Acts, book 5, chapter 43, section A, subsection 2, subsection 1, paragraph 3, line 1. Look at this little thing they got here. And I can detail. Believe it or not, I can detail a lot of sins in a lot of other people. At fine, fine, fine granularity. When it comes to my life, I know I got pride. Help me with that. But Bob over here, let me tell you about Bob. And I go through the list. Again, I think this surfaces in our prayers. It surfaces in the amount of time we spend on which section. It surfaces in our conversations when we can, with pretty good clarity, tell everybody else's faults. It's somewhat analogous to basically saying, okay, here's two canvases the same size. I need to paint a portrait of Bob, and I need you to paint a portrait of yourself. With yourself, you just got this 2-inch brush and 3 colors. But with Bob, you got this fine little brush and 300 different colors on the palette. You can paint near picture perfect over here and the sort of blob over here of your issues. I think that's a decent way to look at this verse. And I've alluded to it, but I have something to tell you that might actually shock you a little bit. I have a great wife. She's a wonderful person. And that's not the shocking part. The shocking part is I can do this exact thing to her. Not only can I do it. I can tell you what almost paragraph after paragraph of all the things I think are wrong with her. And I'm pretty sure if I put a list together, it'd fit in, you know, top of one page for me. It's a dynamic that plays out. And brethren, we are called not to do that. He's saying get rid of the plank. It's not one item, it is broken down too. Into all the same subsections and all the same paragraphs. Discover them, consider them. Focus on that and get rid of that out of your life. I inject this in here because then reconciliation becomes significantly more possible. Brethren, the reality is we are all in a similar situation that we read back in Exodus. Our calling, consider again, back Exodus. Our calling demands that we play the part of God in that story. And I don't say that meaning any form of blasphemous way. But again, Moses has all of this and this contention going on. And he's got this conflict with God. And God's the one that took the initiative. People, all of them, had earned his wrath. They deserved his punishment. And yet God extended his mercy without clearing their guilt. We don't have to forget everything everybody did and act like it didn't happen. But we do have to forgive them. It's an obligation we have. We cannot be like this world, brethren. Our calling, again, is to the uncommon. It is to the extraordinary, the unusual. And the irony of it all, and perhaps this is the nugget of the message, but the irony of it all, it is the very presence of conflict that can be our finest hour. It is the very presence. And I'm not, you know, again, you got to be careful wording these because some people might interpret it as that, oh, you're saying conflict's good. No, I'm not. But in conflict, we can show, we can exhibit and develop some of the most valuable, core, glorious attributes of our God. As I said earlier, we wouldn't even need mercy without conflict. And it is then the presence of conflict, again, that can offer us the opportunity to exhibit what I describe as our finest hour. It's a completely different perspective. And one I would ask all of us to consider. Next time we're in a conflict, ask this. How can I make this situation? How can I take this situation and turn it into a fine hour? A good example based upon what Christ and our Father have done for us. I tell you, I've only recently started thinking down this path. It changes that moment. It changes what I say next. May not change what I think, I will admit that. I hope it does in time. But it does change what is next to come out of my mouth. When it's public conflict, will we exhibit that so the world can see and know that Christ came to this earth? As sort of a sub-point to that, or a backing point, I want to ask this question. What would you say is God's finest hour? Not in the human terms. In the expanse of what we know as time and an eternity, before the angels existed, before the universe existed, some point along the way, God creates all that, and we can see dimly into the future. I guess I should go this way for y'all. We can see dimly into the future. Of all of that, what would you say is God's finest hour, based upon what we know? I hope you will appreciate, I don't know, because I don't know all the past, I don't know all the future, but based upon what I know, out of that massive expanse, I think the 7,000 years He had humans on this earth will be His finest hour. This minor fraction of time in the cosmic sense of the word, God will have been at some of the greatest conflict with His own children. And through His redemptive work, through His glory, through His mercy, through His kindness, He's going to go from a family of two to billions. I think He's going to look at that and say, wow, that's exceptional. That's extraordinary. That was my finest hour. Because that arguably how He dealt with conflict. How He dealt and redeemed and brought back to a reconciled state fallen, broken people that had no other way out. And it will be through the indwelling of Jesus Christ. So I have one last question for all of us to consider. Take that same question and radically narrow it down to our, whatever, 70 years that we get on this earth. And I ask you, what will be your finest hour? What will be yours? Where will you have developed God's glory? Will we, in this life, follow the example of our God and seek purposefully, work at it, labor at it, reconciliation, mercy, grace, goodness, long-suffering, forgiveness, glory of our great God? I want to turn back to Exodus 34. Brethren, we left Moses in our first scripture we read. We left Moses bowing down and worshiping before God who had just showed him this glory. It just showed him who he was. And if you recall, Moses bows down and worships. Remember again the context of all of this and what may well have been, sort of, at least nationally, one of the, if not the most difficult points in Moses' life. All the chaos and all the rebellion and all the death and all the mayhem and God walking away and all this stuff going on. God does this for Moses, shows him this glory. And then Moses has one more question and God gives one more answer. Exodus 34, we'll start in verse 9. Then he said, here's Moses, if now, again, he comes back, right back to it. If now I have found grace in your sight, O Lord, let my Lord, I pray, go amongst us. Even though we are a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us as your inheritance. Brethren, even when we are reconciled, we still walk amongst the imperfect. We too are imperfect, the stiff-necked. Moses has a tremendous acknowledgement. He acknowledges who they are. He doesn't hide it. And he asks that they would continue to be pardoned. He knows he needs the relationship. I read these because these are, again, a summation of our walk. We need that exact thing. That is a request that burns in various words and various phrases in all of our hearts. God's response is found in the next verse. And I find this extraordinarily encouraging. And I want to end basically with this verse. Verse 10. And he said, capital H, this is God. He said, behold, I make a covenant. Behold, I will make an agreement with you. God's words goes gold. He didn't have to do this. He does this for Moses' sake. I will make a covenant with you before all your people. I will do marvels such as have not been done in all the earth nor in any nation. And all the people among whom you are shall see the work of the Lord. Brethren, I ask you, do they see that work? Do they see the work in our lives? The work of the Lord, the work of our God. For it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. Brethren, yes, we are broken sinners. We are a stiff-necked people. We are in desperate need of reconciliation. But it is through that redemptive work, it is through the work of God in our life, that He says, I will do marvelous things. I will do awesome, awesome things. And brethren, I hope and pray history one day records that your time on this earth was your finest hour.